Today's program has been brought to you by Whole Foods Market, a dynamic leader in the quality food business, a mission-driven company that aims to set the standards of excellence for food retailers. For more information, visit WholeFoodsMarket.com.
You're listening to Heritage Radio Network, broadcasting live from Bushwick, Brooklyn. If you like this program, visit HeritageRadioNetwork.org for thousands more.
Good morning and welcome to Taste Matters. I'm your host, Mitchell Davis, Executive Vice President of the James Beard Foundation. And every Wednesday, as you know, because today is Wednesday and it's 11 o'clock, we have a conversation about taste. And today I'm really excited to have with me in the studio someone I've known probably longer than anybody in the food business, someone who has been behind, I would say, a taste trend among the top chefs in the country and who has helped from his perspective oversee and helped move some of those trends along, working with great chefs around the United States and bringing them on the road to all parts of the world. I'm joined today by Michael Gunor, who is the co-founder and co-owner and president of Hudson Valley Foie Gras and New York State Foie Gras, and who is also a chef in his own right and a producer and coordinator of culinary festivals in Asia and elsewhere around the world. Thank you, Michael, for being here.
Pleasure being here.
It's good to have you here in Brooklyn. We also co-authored, I didn't even say, we wrote a book on foie gras together, the definitive book really in the English language, that was your amazing project and that involved 80 chefs around the United States and around the world. And I guess we should start, I mean, let's begin with the foie gras conversation and tell people what it is. What are we even talking about and how do you pronounce it?
Well, the words foie gras obviously come from French, and foie means liver and gras means fat. In a sense, it's the fattened liver of water poultry or waterfowl, in our case, namely the Mullard duck, which is a hybrid duck. And when you feed waterfowl a quantity of food that's to some degree beyond their normal means, the liver grows in size. The early Egyptians discovered that by coincidence, most probably, as you and I know from our extensive research on the book, and the liver grows in size, gains fat, which makes it a very luscious product. And what makes me so proud to be associated with foie gras is it's one of the most, if not the most, ancient food product that exists. People think often of caviar, of lobster, of truffles. Well, all of those have been luxuries for probably 400 or 500 years, where foie gras has a luxurious tradition that probably goes back over 5,000 years, as I said, from the days of the early Egyptians and the Greeks. So basically, we take a particularly breed of duck known as a Mullard, right, and we feed it in a form called hen feeding, or gavage in French, for three times a day for a period of about 22 days. The liver will grow in size from approximately a normal 4 or 5 ounce to approximately 1.5 or 2, and gains a very luxurious flavor and rich flavor and texture. And it's a product that most or many high-end chefs enjoy preparing because it can be done in so many different ways.
I was going to talk to, I mean, obviously we'll get to the question of the production and animal rights and those issues that have come up of late in foie gras, but let's, from the gastronomic standpoint, why do chefs love it? I mean, people go gaga. I've seen it firsthand. You know, strangers who are not French, who don't have a memory of Christmases and New Year's eating foie gras. What do you think it's about it?
You know, funny, that's almost the most difficult question to answer and to have a clearly defined definition as to what makes foie gras what it is. It's very hard to put your fingers on it. I mean, I guess it's very luxuriously textured. It's got a fair amount of fat content, yet it sautés or sears in a very nice manner, almost steak-like, with a really interior that's very lush. In a sense, for the same reason people like bone marrow or like
Wagyu
butter,
beef or something.
Wagyu beef, it's just very luxurious on the palate. People love fat to some degree, and this is fat with texture and with flavor. and it lends itself to be cooked in high heat mechanisms like searing, sautéing, roasting. But at the same time, the classic pâtés and terrines and torchons, which are served cold, cooked at a very low temperature, lend themselves to a whole different type of preparation. And it pairs really well with sweet acidity. So often you'll find foie gras paired with some kinds of jams or chutneys. At the same time, it can be done with a saltier accompaniment. So chefs, whether they are of Italian heritage or French heritage or Asian heritage, can utilize the product in a way that suits their own definition.
Right. So it's funny, we find ourselves at the start of Passover now, and there's actually a Jewish tradition to it, too. We used to joke that we were eating chopped liver or whatever was poor man's foie gras, but in fact, there's a history of Jews producing the livers in Europe and even celebrating Passover sometimes with foie gras in the Middle Ages.
That makes some sense because Jews obviously did not utilize pigs. So back in the day in Eastern Europe, when there was no access to fattier animals such as pigs and so on, ducks and in turn foie gras lent themselves to that high-end food, high-end fat, and became a substitute in a certain sense for pork
ducks
products.
And
ducks, geese.
Oh, interesting. Okay, so people love it. You find it in all sorts of restaurants, mostly high end, but even not sometimes these days.
Right.
And there are all sorts of products around it. And even if people don't like, if you were to call it fat liver, probably it wouldn't be as popular. But it has this allure of foie gras, and this texture. And what is it as bad for you as luscious things seem to be? I mean, what's the nutritional benefit, if any, of eating foie gras?
It's actually an interesting question because there is something that often was discussed several years ago, which was a hot topic known as the French paradox.
Right.
And most people feel the French paradox really had to do with red wine drinking. But more interestingly, it really had to do with foie gras. The question was why the people of Gascony, of southwest France, whose diet mostly is foie gras and ducks and so on, have a lower cardiovascular disease rate than pretty much anywhere else in the world. And what has turned out is that although foie gras is certainly high in fat, it is the good fat and the good cholesterol. So it's probably not nearly as bad for you as you would conceive it or imagine it to be. Then again, people don't have large quantities of foie gras. But bottom line is if you were to have fat, then this is the good fat for what it's worth.
Right. Well, and one of the things we're even realizing now as a consequence of how animals are raised in general, forget ducks for foie gras, but even cows, is that the nature of all fat is different. And if your cows are raised on grass, the chemical composition of their fat is probably more healthy for you than we have been led to believe also. So all fats are not created equal, and even within the animals, all fats are not created the same.
Right. Well, we're clearly not a very large farm in comparison to other poultry operations. We raise about 7,000 foie gras ducks a week, something along those lines, which is not considered a very, very high number of birds. They're all free to roam. They're never individually caged. They're fed by hand as opposed to by pneumatic machines, which is what is often done in France and so on. And, of course, not all farms are created equal. So we're very particular about our ratio of duck to caretakers, about the space they have, about the process that we use, about the corn that they're fed. They're only fed corn. So we're very, very particular about our method of producing and raising these birds.
Are there many other producers in America?
There is one other producer in the United States, and then there are several producers in Canada.
Oh, okay. So what happens with the rest of the duck? I mean, you've got these livers, but there's a whole animal there, and I happen to know that my husband, Nate, duck is his favorite food. And so does the rest get used, or is it just...
Well, actually, I would say that almost in comparison to any other animal, what's interesting about the foie gras duck and duck as a whole is we utilize literally every part of it, which is also interesting in light of today's trends of utilizing whole animals and utilizing every part of the pig, every part of the of cow, and so on and so on. We really do use every single part. So the foie gras, of course, is the marquee product, but the breast of the foie gras duck, which is known as magret, which is M-A-G-R-E-T, is a very nice duck breast, which is often used by various restaurants.
So, and that's what maigre means? Duck, the breast of a foie gras duck?
Right, as opposed to regular duck breast, the word maigre refers specifically to the breast of the foie gras duck, which is a meatier, more flavorful, chewier, larger cut. So the breast of the foie gras duck, for example, is about a pound per breast, where there's two breasts on a duck, where in a regular duck you'd be, you know, a Peking duck or a Muscovy duck, you'd be more towards the half pound. So,
and that's because of the extra feeding, but also the age.
Our correct.
Foie gras ducks are a little bit older, right?
Right. Your normal Peking-style duck, or white duck, is approximately 9 weeks of age when processed, which people would be surprised about.
Right.
People don't realize that your average supermarket chicken is 8 or 9 weeks old. Your average duck is 8 or 9 weeks old. The foie gras duck is considered mature at 16 weeks of age. So ducks for foie gras production, or the Moulard, for example, that we use, are approximately 16 weeks of age. So the breast is, so the combination of the extra 7 weeks as well as the extra feed produces a 1 pound maigre. So the maigre, besides the foie gras, the maigre is another terrific product to use. Now, another classic dish that everybody knows is confit. Means to preserve something in its own fat. Being that this is an older duck and the leg is a tougher leg, the best way to produce it is to confit it, meaning to cure it, to eliminate moisture, which is a hotbed for bacteria, which creates shelf life, and then to go ahead after 2 days of curing in salt and pepper and sugar and spices to then cook the duck leg very, very slowly in its own fat. And once you do that and recover it, chill it and recover in fat, you can hold it up to 6 months or even a year. So that tenderizes the leg. And as a matter of fact, I keep telling my partner, who is a brilliant producer, Izzy and I, that if he was such a good producer, he'd find a way to produce four legs on every single duck, because we have more demand actually for the legs of the foie gras duck than we do for the foie gras itself. And then, of course, the fat is a great form of fat. There's many chefs who will, for example, fry French fries and other things in duck fat.
Sure.
It's very popular in France. The skin is used for pâtés and so on. Any extra meat is used for pâtés as well. The duck wings are very, very popular. And we even sell the feathers for down. So, and of course, the heart, the gizzard, even the testicles are all used by different
tongues. The tongue, you see in Chinese restaurants.
Everything but the quack. So the feet, of course, are very, very popular. There's not enough of that in the world. We just got a request from China for 10,000 pounds of duck feet, which we don't even have. And it's surprisingly that they would be short of duck feet in China. But literally every single...
All the duck feet in China.
Exactly. Every single part of the duck that the USDA deems edible is sold. Huh. So there's pretty much a 100% utilization. And interestingly, chefs are finding ways to use various parts that are not as expensive. And it might not be the foie gras that they would use, but they find a way to know. We've also found that duck has, on the whole, become very, very popular.
Sure.
We actually now have a new line, which is called the Rouen duck, which we went from literally zero production to 10,000 birds a week, which is a non-foie gras duck called the Rouen, which is very popular with chefs. And I think as beef and pork, veal have gotten more and more expensive, we were able to keep the price of duck very reasonable, and it's become a very, very popular choice in restaurants.
Mm. So let's go to the hard question. I'm sure there are people listening who have heard or supported organizations that just believe foie gras is the most egregious thing you can do to an animal. Obviously, we've passed that moment where cities and states were fighting to ban or protest or whatever, but it's still a hot topic. What do you say to those people as someone behind the production of 7,000 foie gras ducks a week? Do you go to bed at night with a clear conscience?
Well, as old as foie gras is, the controversy regarding the production of foie gras has always been at its shadow. Being Passover, we'll mention Rashi, which was a very well-known Jewish historian and theologian, who already raised hundreds of years ago his concerns regarding the production of foie gras. And to the naked eye, the fact that we use a system known as, well, gavage in French, but some say force feeding in English, where the duck is quote-unquote forced to, where a funnel is placed in the duck's throat and food is in a sense, forced. It seems to the naked eye to be a very anti-animal right thing to do, because if we humanize the process, obviously it's something we don't think we'd want done to us. But when you really understand the anatomy of a duck and how a duck eats, and the duck gorges prior to migration and grows the size of its liver by two times in order to survive a 5 or 7 day migration period without access to food, and if you understood that a duck builds that extra energy around its liver in the form of fat, and if you understand that ducks have a calcified esophagus that allows it to be fed in that manner, the ducks don't chew their food but rather swallow it whole and do not have a gag reflex. When you put all that together and you really understand the process, you understand that there are no animal rights issues involved. But being that it's two French words, which means fat duck, and being that it's a luxurious product that technically be assumed to be eaten just by the wealthy, it's a very, and this process of feeding the duck, it's a very easy target for animal rights activists. It's much easier to attack foie gras as a part of a platform than it is to attack the beef industry or the chicken industry and so on. But at the end of the day, we have less mortality rates than any other poultry operation. The animals are cared for better than any other poultry operation. There's no stress involved. There's no pain involved. The USDA has, and veterinarians around the world have checked this process through and through many, many times, and every single time deemed it to be a non-animal right issue. And so I think that people need to understand the facts and then make their own decisions as to whether it's something they want to partake in.
I think I can already see the lines lighting up now with people who are going to call and write in and hear about that. Obviously, there's a decision to raise animals for food or not for food, which is a different decision from whether or not one way to do that is different from another or has an impact on the animals. Souls, I don't know what we say.
Right. Here we have that extra impact of which involves the way these animals are fed. Obviously, the animal rights platform is not, I mean, their general platform is whether we should or should not eat animals to begin with.
Right. That's
but
a different question.
Here in particular, it always begins and ends with this particular price, this particular method of feeding the ducks. And that's what people need to be enlightened on.
I will say there was a book a few years ago by Mark Caro called
The Duck Wars.
The Foie Gras Wars. And I, having spent so much time with you and writing about it, I sort of picked it up reluctantly just because here we go again. But to me, it was a really compelling, brilliant analysis of both the pros and cons and also just the whole environment in which those things happen. The characters behind some of the ruling, in particular in Chicago, about banning foie gras and then rescinding that and that sort of stuff. And I would recommend everyone read it just to see what the details and the facts and the sort of strategies behind it are. It was really interesting.
And funny enough, that book really originated because of the controversy with, at the time, Chef Charlie Trotter in Chicago, who suddenly decided he does not want to serve foie gras at his own restaurant. And then there were various issues between Charlie and other chefs in Chicago. And the whole thing bloomed into a city ban on foie gras, which, as you said, was rescinded approximately a year or so later on. We have a similar issue today in California, which for various reasons banned the production and sale of foie gras, which, of course, we are hoping to one day rescind as well. But that's a more complicated issue because it's a state regulation as opposed to a city regulation. We clearly hope that that's not a precedent. And again, if you really understood the reasons behind California's move to do that, you'd understand that there's more to it than meets the eye, as Mark Caro explains in his book.
Okay, we're going to take a quick break. So start writing your letters to me of protest and pick at me while we listen to some music. I'm talking to Michael Gnor, who's the founder and president of Hudson Valley Foie Gras. This is Taste Matters.
Program has been brought to you by Whole Foods Market. Are you a locavore? Our Northeast regional forager for Whole Foods Market sure is. She spends her time traveling around the New York City metro area sourcing the best new or interesting artisanal and handcrafted local products for our purchasing teams at the local store level. Part of our commitment to our local suppliers includes assisting them with the process of getting their products sold at our stores. Whether it's suggesting packaging designs, pricing, or distribution methods, she's helping some of the area's best new products reach savvy shoppers at Whole Foods Market stores. Today, New York. Tomorrow, the world. For more information, visit WholeFoodsMarket.com.
Welcome back to Taste Matters. I'm your host, Mitchell Davis. I'm talking with Michael Gunor, who is who we are affiliating as the co-founder, co-owner, and president of Hudson Valley Foie Gras, but who also, in the course of his 20-odd years in that business, has led, been at the forefront, really, of the new American cuisine movement, both because of his relationships with chefs over his product, but also just because of his interest and relationship with chefs and American food and representing it abroad and across the country. He's been a big supporter of the Beard Foundation and of many of the names that have become household names. He's been behind some of that promotion. So let's move off of the topic of foie gras. I'll give people the call-in number just in case they can't let it go. 718-497-2128 if you're listening, or if you're listening to the podcast or prefer to write info@heritageradionetwork.org or tweet us at TasteMattersHRN. But let's talk about in the last 20 years or so that we've known each other, what you've seen changes in trends in food. I feel like when we first met, there were these names that have become sort of the essence of the celebrity chef, Todd Ingram and Mario Batali and even Danielle Ballou and all these folks who were at the time new sensations and now are kind of the godfathers of the movement. And there's this whole other thing going on. We're here at Roberta's, which wouldn't have existed or been possible before those guys came around, but is sort of the essence of the current food trend and young 28-year-old bearded, tattooed men and women who are cooking their hearts out, using local ingredients, trying to engage with what it means to be a chef and to create American cuisine and to have a notion of craft in everything they do. How'd we get here? What's
well,
your perspective?
Hopefully not too many bearded women.
Yeah.
But
whatever.
Tattooed, we're okay.
Equal opportunity radio station.
Well, I have to say that you and I both have, as far as I'm concerned, have lived through probably the most interesting 20-plus years of the American food scene.
Sure.
What we've seen, and I would even go further to say probably on a worldwide basis, what we've seen happen in the last 20 years in the United States and in many other parts of the world has really been unmatched at any other time. When you and I started growing up in this industry, we wouldn't think of London as a food destination. We wouldn't think of
Minneapolis or anything, right?
Certainly that.
Right.
We wouldn't think of Eastern Europe as a food. Spain wasn't even on our radar except for something called paella. That was the only thing. And look what has happened on a worldwide basis. And I think from that standpoint, the food is in the most interesting place today than it's ever been. You can go to just about any corner of the United States and find very decent food, farm to table, in whole animal. We're much more open to those foods than we ever were. And you'd find the same to be true whether you went to Singapore or you went to Saigon or anywhere else.
Places
in the world.
Places you go all the time, we should
right.
say. Yeah.
So I've seen, it's very interesting for me because as we are on the internet and with the access to information and communication, the world has become a much smaller place when it comes to that. A chef can very quickly not just learn about a product without having to go to the library and so on and so on. But in minutes, you know everything you need to know about kefir lime and how to use it and so on and so on, where that just wasn't available to us. We have transportation methods that allow us to get product. For example, I could ship foie gras anywhere in the world within 24 hours.
That's amazing.
And by the same token, I can use lemongrass and ginger that comes in either fresh from elsewhere or grown here. So we have access to product. We have access to information. We have refrigeration. We have roads. It's really revolutionized the food world. That's in the macro. In the micro, chefs are so much more aware of various other ingredients. Is, you know, anyone can cook a filet mignon, but taking kidneys or hearts or and trotters and making them taste right really is much more of a skill. And with the audience being open to it, whether it's a hipster audience or as we are sitting here at Roberta's, which hopefully we'll do a foie gras pizza as well, we find that there's just that much more openness to it. And I think also as we've what we've seen is as we to some degree walk away from having to necessarily have high-end food at a very high-end three-star Michelin, now we're finding that we can sit in environments that are much more less stuffy, in a way more pleasant, not to take away from New York's and the world's Michelin or four-star restaurants, which are still phenomenal dining experiences, but are good once in a while. We can now find great food without having to necessarily pay for the window dressing.
Can I ask if you think, since you've been a part of the movement in such a profound way, do you think that that casualization of eating, of the environment, not the food, is sort of an American influence on the world or a gift of America, let's say, or has it come from other forces also? Because to me, sometimes when I go into a restaurant, even in Japan or in France, it feels like more American because of the nature of the experience, not the food so much, but it just seems like that might be something we've exported.
I would argue that that's definitely the case. Now, when we walk around the world, we're not going to be held only responsible for the hamburger.
Right.
But rather for that, I certainly do feel that where it is taking hold in other places in the world, Southeast Asia and anywhere for that matter, it is definitely an American sensibility. Mm. The French have traditionally only dined high-end at Michelin high-end restaurants with waitstaff that's dressed to the hilt and certain amount of wine glasses and tablecloth on the table and so on and so on. These days, in restaurants in Paris such as Spring, which is certainly American influence, or Frenchy, or La Comptoire and so on and so on, you certainly feel that casualness, which didn't exist there 10 years ago. And certainly that is something that started in the United States and I think is not just a trend, but rather here to stay.
Now, you are someone I happen to know who appreciates the sort of complexity and intensity of Southeast Asia. You mentioned the flavors of the cuisines there, all sorts of foods like that. And what you described as the access that American chefs now have to all sorts of things can also lead to confusion, let's say, instead of fusion cuisine. Do you think we're becoming, or American cooks are becoming more sophisticated with their adoption of these things? Or is there still, is it a crapshoot sometimes? Because having so much at your disposal can be a good thing and a bad thing from the from what's cooked, let's say.
Well, I think basically you're asking about the question of fusion. And people love to knock fusion, but I think cooking is all about fusion. Right. It always was and always will be. It's just that sometimes we look at it, you know, myopically in a very short time frame as opposed to, I mean, people don't, when you think of food in Southeast Asia, you often think, for example, of chilies or spice. And only when you study it, you realize that 400 years ago, literally, there were no chilies in Southeast Asia. It's a product that came from North America. So certainly fusion is something that takes experimentation and takes time and takes adaptability. When I was growing up in Israel, for example, you couldn't find cilantro, and it was all about parsley, and today cilantro is considered part of Middle Eastern cuisine. Right. So I think that the issue of fusion and confusion is really not the case. I'm a huge fusion believer. I think that you will not find any nearly really successful restaurants that don't have some form of it on their menu, some more, some less. At my own restaurant, this is a shameless self-promotion, Lola, which is in Great Neck Long Island, I do my whole menu is fusion, but I've traveled extensively. I've learned extensively, and I try to do the best I can to incorporate those ingredients in a proper manner. But I think that if you look what seems to be fusion today, in 20 or 30 years will certainly not be.
Right. And it'll sort of recede and become part of the cuisine.
Exactly.
I just learned this morning at breakfast that Korea is the number one export destination for American cheese, and that hundreds of thousands of pounds of cheese find their way across these, in the last 10 years has been a craze, find their way into all sorts of traditional Korean dishes. Go figure.
And that's very interesting because traditionally there was very little dairy.
Sure. Well, there's very little dairy in American cheese too, so it's perfect.
Right? There's very little dairy available in Asia for various reasons.
I actually think it's probably the salt umami quality that makes it amenable in some ways. That nature, the funkiness factor that obviously Korean food and a lot of those cuisines based on fermented flavors, Thai cuisine, all those sorts of stuff have you incorporate things that you understand a little bit, flavor profiles that make sense to you.
Well, which goes back to show that the world has become, food-wise, a much, much smaller place, sure, in a certain sense. And so the fact that those products make it there, and by the same token, you'll see so many American chefs using Korean influences in their food in one form or another, whether it's marinating meat like kalbi or using the chili sauces that the Koreans
kimchi,
use.
Kimchi, which now is a household term one had ever heard of 110
You're
years ago.
You're having kimchi as a topping on tacos these days, which is one of the most popular trends in food trucks in Los Angeles. Yeah. So we certainly see this crossover happening all the time.
So what excites you right now? If you had to choose a chef to cook your meals at home, where would he or she come from?
That's a great question. I'm very fond of Thai food. Yeah. I think it's something that I can eat every single day. It's such a wide, you know, I need flavor. I'm at a point now where I really need every bite to pop. I get a little bit, I'm one of those guys who can't really eat a whole bowl of pasta, for example.
Yeah, we fight about this regularly.
I know. Right? It's been a topic of conversation for 20 years. Because after 2-3 bites of gnocchi or whatever it is, I'm bored. Where with Asian food, Southeast Asia, Asian food in the whole, every bite to me is exciting. It's complex. It's got sweet notes, sour notes, spicy notes, sweet notes, and it's every bite to me is exciting, and I kind of need that in my own way. So so if I had to pick one cuisine that I would eat can eat regularly because it's got its share of curries and stir fries and noodles and salads with a very wide variety, that's probably would be my go-to cuisine. Although everything I do is still steeped in the classics. I have huge respect for French cuisine, for French classics, and still in everything I do, even if it's a Thai dish, I still rely on certain French techniques and things that I've learned with, for example, Jean-Louis Paladin, who I worked with for a long time, was a phenomenal French chef. And so I go back to that as a base in no matter what it is that I do. But as far as
the flavors
go,
and ingredients,
and the mentality of the food, the approach to the food, I do tend to. But what's so interesting about food, it's kind of like almost picking your favorite child. It's you love them all, and I find great food anywhere in the world that I go to. I'm really happy eating barbecue in Kansas City. I'm cooking actually for the James Beard Foundation in Nashville in a couple of weeks, and really excited about seeing Sean's restaurant there called Husk, who's doing Southern Switzerland food. And like you said, Minneapolis, anywhere you go, you really find, and I always like to find the ethnic, local, whether it's, you know, Mexican food in Chicago and Vietnamese food in Houston. I mean, if you know how to look, if you know what to find, then you'll always find really interesting cuisines. And I learn every single time, every single trip.
Well, somehow we've passed 30 minutes talking, although we've passed almost 30 years, it feels like, sometimes, so there's a lot more to say. Thank you for joining us. It's great
to
talk to you.
Thank you for having me.
Always. I hope that you'll be back soon. This is Taste Matters. I'm your host. Next week we are welcoming someone I can see on my sheet who is... Ruth Reichel. No, next week there's no show, but the week after that we'll be welcoming Ruth Reichel, who has written yet another book, a new novel called Delicious, and we'll talk about how delicious it is. In the meantime, why don't you find, go exploring on Michael's advice, and find an ethnic experience that you might not have, or you've wanted an excuse to try, or might not have had an opportunity to locate in your community, because taste matters. Thanks for listening.
Thank you. And I just want to say just always going to remember that I was your first assignment in the food world.
Right. I didn't say that. I should have said that. Right. I got a job in the writing about food, and the next day they said at 6:30, this guy's going to pick you up and take you to a foie gras farm. So that might discredit anything that we've said on the show, except that Michael has been a mentor and a great friend. So thanks again for listening.
Thank you for having me.
Thanks for listening to this program on HeritageRadioNetwork.org. You can find all of our archived programs on our website, or as podcasts in the iTunes Store by searching Heritage Radio Network. You can like us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter at @heritage_radio. You can email us questions at any time at info@heritageradionetwork.org. Heritage Radio Network is a nonprofit organization. To donate and become a member, visit our website today. Thanks for listening.